Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'm the host for tonight's Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted you're here and delighted to welcome Gary Gildner, who was our guest tonight. Before I introduce Mr. Gildner, I would like to thank Schuler Books and Music for being here and making available Gary Gildner's books for sale, and I'm sure for signings afterwards. We're always happy that Schuler Books is here and happy for their sponsorship of the Michigan Writers Series. It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you Gary Gildner. Gary Gildner was born and raised in West Branch, Michigan. He received his undergraduate and graduate degrees in English from Michigan State University in 1960 and 1961, respectively. Gary Gildner's 20 published books include Blue Like the Heavens, New and Selected Poems, Somewhere Geese Are Flying, New and Selected Stories, The Second Bridge, Warsaw Sparks, My Grandfather's Book, and The Bunker in the Parsley Fields, which received the 1996 Iowa Poetry Prize. He has also received a National Magazine Award for Fiction, Pushcart Prizes in Fiction and Nonfiction, the Robert Frost Fellowship, the William Carlos Williams and Theodore Rottke Poetry Prizes, and two National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships. Gildner has been writer in residence at Reed College, Davidson College, Seattle University, and Michigan State University, and has been a senior Fulbright lecturer to Poland and to Czechoslovakia. He has given readings of his works at the Library of Congress, the Academy of American Poets, the YMYWHA, Manhattan Theater Club, and at some 300 colleges and schools in the U.S. and abroad. I'm pleased to add that Special Collections has acquired the papers and manuscripts of Gary Gildner, which will be made available for use by researchers shortly. Gary Gildner and his family currently reside on a ranch in Idaho. Gary Gildner's writings has brought high praise from critics and fellow writers alike. Alice Munro, for example, commenting on Somewhere Geese Are Flying, has written, "There's such a good feeling about these stories, that the writer knows his people, the whole texture of their lives in different lights, that he'll take you a long way into them, and you'll always be surprised and satisfied in the right way, never tricked or betrayed." Mr. Gildner will read, and then afterwards take a few questions from the audience. Please join me in welcoming Gary Gildner.
Thank you, Peter. So the technician said that I can walk around and, right? Because I'm all set to go, I don't have to touch anything. I'm delighted to be here again. I was here 3 years ago, and had a good time, and now I'm here again, and I'm having a good time already. I haven't even started. I'm in the middle of I'm 1 month into a tour, nothing bad has happened yet. No flat tires, no coals. I've shown up, and everything is just as it should be, except that the Yankees keep winning ball games that they should not be winning, despite the maniacs who root for them.
You're gonna lose. I'm telling you that now.
I wish I had a story to read to you about the Yankees just performing in abysmal fashion.
And that would be hard to find.
When you run into a Yankees fan, it's always an experience, isn't it? It's a test of character. Well, this Yankee fan did request a story, and I read this story a lot. I enjoy reading it, and I'm happy to read it again. And because it's short, I can probably read this and one other. It's an unusual story for me in that I had carried the germ of it around for many years. It was in the form of an anecdote that I had heard growing up. And it wasn't until I heard it several times and then checked up at a music shop, checked up by looking up the sheet music of the song Sleepy Time Gal to see if my parents were telling the truth, that one of them had in fact known the composer of that song. And anyway, I was telling this anecdote to a friend of mine, Richard Salzer, at Yaddo one summer, and after I finished, he said, "Don't say anything more, just go to your studio and type it up." And Dick is a surgeon, he used to practice at Yale, and I always listened to my doctor, so I went to my studio and I typed it up, and in typing it up, I discovered how to turn the anecdote into a story. It's called Sleepy Time Gal. In the small town in northern Michigan where my father lived as a young man, he had an Italian friend who worked in a restaurant. I will call his friend Phil. Phil's job in the restaurant was as ordinary as you can imagine, from making coffee in the morning to sweeping up at night. But what was not ordinary about Phil was his piano playing. On Saturday nights, my father and Phil and their girlfriends would drive 10 or 15 miles to a roadhouse by a lake where they would drink beer from Schuppers and dance, and Phil would play an old beat-up piano. "He could play any song you named," my father said, "but the song everyone waited for was the one he wrote, which he would always play at the end before they left to go back to the town." And everyone knew, of course, that he had written the song for his girl, who was as pretty as she was rich. Her father was the banker in their town, and he was a tough old German, and he didn't like Phil going around with his daughter. My father, when he told this story, which was not often, would tell it in an offhand way and emphasize the depression and not having much instead of the important parts. I will try to tell it the way he did, if I can. So they would go to the roadhouse by the lake, and finally Phil would play his song, and everyone would say, "Phil, that's a great song. You could make a lot of money from it." But Phil would only shake his head and smile and look at his girl. I have to break in here and say that my father, a gentle but practical man, was not inclined to emphasize the part about Phil looking at his girl. It was my mother who said the girl would rest her head on Phil's shoulder while he played, and that he got the idea for the song from the pretty way she looked when she got sleepy. My mother was not part of the story, but she had heard it when she and my father were younger and therefore had that information. I would like to intrude further and add something about Phil writing the song. Maybe show him whistling the tune and going over the words slowly and carefully to get the best ones while peeling onions or potatoes in the restaurant. But my father is already driving them home from the roadhouse and saying how patched up his tires were and how his car's engine was a gingerbread of parts from different makes, and some parts were his own invention as well. And my mother is saying that the old German had made his daughter promise not to get involved with any man until after college, and they couldn't be late. Also, my mother likes the sad parts and is eager to get to their last night before the girl goes away to college. So they all went out to the roadhouse, and it was sad. The women got tears in their eyes when Phil played her song, my mother said. My father said that Phil spent his week's pay on a new shirt and tie, the first tie he ever owned, and people kidded him. Somebody piped up and said, "Phil, you ought to take that song down to Bay City," which was like saying New York City to them, only more realistic, "and sell it and take the money and go to college too." Which was not meant to be cruel, but that was the result because Phil had never even got to high school. But you can see people were trying to cheer him up, my mother said. Well, she'd come home for Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter, and they'd all sneak out to the roadhouse and drink beer from Schuppers and dance, and everything would be like, and of course, there were the summers. And everyone knew Phil and the girl would get married after she made good her promise to her father, because you could see it in their eyes when he sat at the old beat-up piano and played her song. That last part about their eyes was not, of course, in my father's telling, but I couldn't help putting it in there, even though I know it is making some of you impatient. Remember that this happened many years ago in the woods by a lake in northern Michigan before television. I wish I could put more in, especially about the song and how it felt to Phil to sing it, and how the girl felt when hearing it and knowing it was hers. But I've already intruded too much in a simple story that isn't even mine. Well, here's the kicker part. Probably by now, many of you have guessed that one vacation near the end, she doesn't come home to see Phil because she meets some guy at college who is good-looking and as rich as she is. And because her father knew about Phil all along and was pressuring her into forgetting about him, she gives in to this new guy and goes to his hometown during the vacation and falls in love with him. That's how the people in town figured it, because after she graduates, they turn up, already married. And right away, he takes over the old German's bank, buys a new Pontiac at the place where my father is the mechanic, and pays cash for it. Paying cash always made my father pause and shake his head and mention again that times were tough. But here comes this guy in a spiffy white shirt, with French cuffs, my mother said, and pays the full price in cash. And this made my father shake his head, too. Phil took the song down to Bay City and sold it for $25, the only money he ever got for it. It was the same song we just heard on the radio, and which reminded my father of the story I just told you. What happened to Phil? Well, he stayed in Bay City and got a job managing a movie theater. My father saw him there after the Depression when he was on his way to Detroit to work for Ford. He stopped, and Phil gave him a box of popcorn. The song he wrote for the girl has sold many millions of records, and if I told you the name of it, you could probably sing it, or at least whistle the tune. Wonder what the girl thinks when she hears it. Oh yes, my father met Phil's wife too. She worked in the movie theater with him, selling tickets and cleaning the carpet after the show with one of those sweepers you push. She was also big and loud, nothing like the other one, my mother said. Here's another short one. This one got started when I was living in Czechoslovakia. And I really should memorize this story, and I will, I think, by and by. Because I think it's a story that I think should sound like it's part of an oral tradition. I bring this guy, Pavel Hudak, up on the stage, and I just have him start talking. I don't mean a literal stage. I just bring him into the story and let him start talking. He does. It's called Pavel Hudak, the poet, is talking. Pavel is drinking hard cider for breakfast. You would not guess this, but he is a very good pickpocket. He travels to pretty Levice, a prosperous town. I could make a fine living here, he thinks. Rich merchants, doctors, foreign tourists. I can slip money from their coats and trousers like a magician. So this is what I do. I move here. You yourself, Gary, can see how successful I am. As I drink cider for breakfast while others slave away. One morning in the main square, I observe a beautiful woman walking toward me. She is such a wonderful sight, my eyes go weak as she approaches. I can only look at her face a few moments, then I must look down at her basket of flowers. I am suddenly bashful like a boy. I even stumble as we pass each other. I am in the clouds, a confused and lucky leaf. I touch my chest to calm my heart. Wait, breathe slowly, Pavel. What is this? My purse is not in my shirt here where I always keep it. I am certain I brought it with me when I left my room only moments ago. I stopped nowhere, saw no one except the beauty. Is it possible she took it? I am ashamed and astounded at this thought. And curious, too, very curious. I turn, I run after her. My heart is beating. I say to her, excuse me, please. I must ask you a stupid question. Eyes are a glory to look at. I am only Pavel, a poet, and, to tell the truth, a pickpocket. I ran after you because I am curious. Did you, by any chance, take my purse? Please, you can relax. I won't tell the police if you did. She looks at me a long moment, up and down. I tell you her eyes are the color of grass and sky. Impossible, I know, but that's the truth. Finally, she says, yes, in fact, I did. We talk. I want to say a poem to her, but this other news of her great gift, as good as my own, is what we discuss. In short, I suggest we work together. We can be fantastic. So this is what we do, Gary. We become a team. We make so much money, we buy a house. We become lovers, of course. It is inevitable. And one day we decide to marry. Why not? We can have children. We can teach them what we know. We can retire into a nice old age and let our kids do the work. So Slavka becomes pregnant, blooms into a garden, a moon. Forgive me, but I lose myself remembering. And it's amazing how this new condition makes her an even better pickpocket. Because she doesn't seem the type, does she? She can get closer to people. They trust her, offer their arms, and so forth. Then the baby is ready. I run for the midwife, the best one. She brings out from Slavka a boy, Pavel, named after me. He is fine looking, has those miracle eyes of his mother, and is healthy, except for one thing. He holds his left arm close to his chest. I try very gently to pull it away, but he resists. He will reach up to me with his right hand, but his left he keeps to himself, clutched in a fist beside his heart. Time, I think, will fix things. Perhaps his coming into the world during winter was too shocking, too cold. Although the midwife took care to bundle him quickly and hold him close, I watched, so I know. Thus we wait, doing all we can to encourage little Pavel to relax his arm, open his hand. We bathe him, caress him, sing to him. Not even my best poems whispered in his ear will help. The doctors, some whose pockets I once picked, all tell us the same thing. Do not worry, nothing physically is wrong. After all, he is only an infant. But I am impatient, Slavka too, and we take Pavel to a woman in the country who is said by many to have old wisdom. Few even call her a witch. In truth, she looked like one, her hair all stuck out, no teeth. She gazed at Pavel a long time. This, she started to touch him, but pulled her hand back. This made me nervous. I was ready to leave. She said, no, wait. Shivering, she gathered her rag of a shawl tighter. She tossed more sticks on her fire. Then she threw a handful of grain into the flames. Give me money, she said, and I will tell you what to do. Give me money now. I paid her. She counted it, the witch. Then she said to go home and tie a small piece of gold on a string and dangle it over the baby. We followed her instructions. We tied one of Slavka's gold earrings on a string and I held it like this. I could see him look at it. His fabulous eyes had birds in them, a whole forest. He raised his right hand. I moved the earring closer to his left hand. Slowly, very slowly, the little hand came away from his chest. The little fingers began to open. They opened so slowly, I thought a week went by. And this is why, Gary, he was already holding something. Something very shiny. Do you know what it was? In his little palm, he was holding the midwife's wedding ring. Pavel, the poet, looked into his own left palm. Then he looked at me and winked. I raised my glass. Very good, I said. Do you think so, he said. Absolutely, I said. Will it make me rich, he said. Don't you mean richer, I said. Of course, he said. He clinked his glass against mine, gave me another wink, and said, to happiness. He finished his cider in one gulp, then, lifting his face toward the sky, eyes closed, he recited the following poem. Really, you saw a hawk there, swooping without mercy on yellow hens. That's life, diving head down. I didn't know he was going to do that to me at the very end of the story, but he did. Well, I those went by rather quickly, didn't they? Want to hear another one? Want to hear something else? Let's see. Does the old Yankee fan have another request?
Oh no.
Well, let's see here. Here's one I've never read before. Let's just try this out. It's called Genealogy. Since we were talking about historical things, historical, genealogical earlier, Michael and I. Sammy was staring at the space marked experience on an application form. The form was for a job she had no interest in. If she got it, she would spend 8 hours a day in a windowless room and couldn't wear jeans. She would put folders in filing cabinets and take them out again. She would twist paper clips into skinny little wire people and in general go nuts. But what else could she do now that she was back in Iowa? Teaching her refugees English would pay about half the heat bill this winter. "Have a goat," Ty said, all smiles, when she explained her situation. "For the milk." "Oh, sure," Sammy said. "I could keep it in my landlord's marigold patch." Sammy had told her students about living in Iowa years ago when she was a young girl. She told them about the small farm her parents had owned, about the goats they raised, the honeybees, the popcorn they planted above the orchard that sold as far away as Chicago, with their names on the jars. She told Ty and Tuan and Mai and the others that her parents had a barn with a good space for a mule, so they traded for one and put him in it, Howard. She told her students, with the aid of pictures she drew on the blackboard, that her parents had carved ducks and wove rugs and played, if they could believe it, the spoons. But she did not tell them that one spring, the spring Sammy was 14, they picked up and moved to California to make ocean burgers in a restaurant in Oceanside. Sitting at her kitchen table and circling the word experience on the application form, Sammy remembered that they bought the restaurant, Happy Joe's, without seeing it. They saw only a photograph mailed to them in Iowa by Happy Joe himself. The photograph showed the owner, roly-poly in a tall white chef's hat, standing at the entrance to the place. He had one arm around a pretty girl and the other arm around a soldier. The girl held a pinkish poodle and was helping it wave a paw. And in a letter, Happy Joe wrote something like this: that Oceanside had boku servicemen and boku tourists, and every one of them was crazy about his ocean burgers. He said the place was King Solomon's mine. But he'd made his bundle and now had his sights set on shoeless days in a hammock under the palm trees watching the sun do its thing. Sammy's parents had had a good laugh over Happy Joe. But they did it. They went out there with all seven kids in the school bus her dad converted into a camper before campers were popular and made ocean burgers. The only thing special about the burgers that Sammy can remember was the bright blue cardboard whale they were served in. For just about a year, and oh, it got long, her parents and she and her sister Ursula, too, on weekends, filled those cardboard whales with ocean burgers. Then they sold Happy Joe's to their best customer, a soldier who had chipmunks tattooed on his biceps. When he flexed his muscles, the animal's cheeks puffed out. His name was Boo Rapp, and Sammy had a terrible crush on him. She wrote "Boo" on her kneecaps in red lipstick and wore jeans so no one would see it and refused to go swimming until his name burned through her skin to her soul. Oh, yes. But they never even kissed because Boo was a man with a mission and a motto: no hot women and no hot cars. And no booze or funny tobacco either. Just ocean burgers. Retail success was his aim in life. He'd joined Uncle Sam's army to save up capital and to keep his nose clean, and if he'd slipped once, those chipmunks, a man wasn't a zombie either. He told Sammy all this one night in the parking lot over a Dr. Pepper they were sharing, and to this day, though she can laugh at her youth, she cannot drink anything sweet from a bottle. Her parents, of course, were elated that Boo Rapp came along. No, elated's not the right word. Lucky. Lucky that he came along. His discharge imminent and his aim in life clear, for they were ready to move on. Sammy sighed. They were 39 that year, the same age she was now. Now they were 64 and doing what? Oh, she could fill the space marked experience with 25 years of geography and good intentions and dreams, and like a piece of chopped meat on a bun in a cardboard whale, what would it all mean? 64, divorced, but sharing the same house. Her mother downstairs, her father upstairs, in Aunt Jelly's former sewing room paying rent, and out front on the lawn, a sign advertising vitamins and foot care. And at the bottom of the sign, her mother's name in old English lettering, Thelma Goodrow Dunley. All right here in Des Moines, an hour's drive from the goats and bees and Howard the Mule they picked up and drove away from a quarter of a century ago. And now back. How many times have they been back? Back through. All but the twins, the babies, Holly and Teak. Me and Ursula and Brendan and William and Georgia, she thought, listing their names from the eldest down in the space that asked for experience. And Thelma and Jack, she said aloud, adding their names too. Then she looked up and gazed out the window at nothing. No, not nothing. A freeway. And over it, a bridge for school kids to walk on, to get back and forth, swinging their lunch pails, smoking their brave cigarettes, shrieking, spitting down on cars, yelling out, I do not love Junior Potts. Tell us another one. And straight up the freeway, the Capitol's golden dome, bright as a hat from the Renaissance, which her parents had marched to, arms linked with hundreds to help stop the war. Hell no, we won't go. Boston, Columbus, San Francisco, Madison, Denver, you name the place, Jack and Thelma and their seven kids were there, holding up signs, smiling at the pigs. Pigs, she had to laugh. They'd raised pigs too for a while. Even had one, Bridget, whose mother tried to eat it, housebroke. And Dan Rather said, get those kids with a pig. And for 3 seconds, you couldn't blink, Aunt Jelly said, they were on TV, coast to coast, the whole family, American as all get out, while the country fell apart. Which made her think, now, of Sweet Holly and Handsome Teak. In fact, if she had a TV set, she could flip it on and probably see one or the other at that very moment, suffering some awful, hokey dilemma. Soap stars. Is that ironic? Or what? Do you watch them, Papa? Talk, talk, talk. He'd walked over to have supper with her last night. When she answered the door, there stood a goofy Richard Nixon in a long brown coat holding a Target shopping bag. Trick or treat, he said, sounding so small behind the rubber mask that she wanted to close the door, count to 10, and try it again. It smells like a damn hospital. My apartment, she said. This thing, and he took off the mask. Did I scare you? I scared the lady downstairs. Mother? No, not your mother. She has no time or inclination to have her blood excited. The lady below you, your friend, the dancer. Let's see what she gave me. He reached in the shopping bag and pulled out a Tootsie Roll. He studied it a moment, then put it in his mouth like a cigar. Say, girlie, which way to the egress? The eyebrows hopped, but his voice, oh, such a little instrument it had become. She hugged him. Was she dreaming, or was he even smaller than just a few days ago? In the short time since she'd been back, her father, Daly, seemed to be going away, inch by inch. Please, Papa, no jokes. Stay. She helped him off with the heavy army surplus coat and gave him a glass of Bushmills. Food. I will feed this little man whose hair should not be half so white, whose eyes seem elsewhere. Where are you, Papa? Good question. I mean, a penny for your thoughts. Your mother gets these Masons from the reservation. He laughed. Now that's the song title for you, Masons from the Reservation. He ruminated, pulling his chin. I refer to these ladies, retired, who come on a bus. She snips off their corns and oils their bunions. What an occupation. Oh, dear. That's what I say. No, I meant we're having corn chowder tonight. Ah, well, I should keep my trap shut. He sipped his whiskey. But I'll tell you one thing. I'm not moving into one of those abominations. You won't have to, ever. Nor bounce from one unlucky child to the next. No, Papa. He gazed at his feet. You're all back now, except for those two. Holy St. Francis. One's supposed to be a nurse, I guess. She wears a white cap. She's up to no good with a pair of doctors. And the other one's, what's he supposed to be? He's up to no good with a pair of women lawyers. Talk, talk, talk. Don't they ever get tired of it? So you have seen them. Seen them? I have witnessed a mockery of 2,000 years. Then the witches and goblins and hard to guess what started coming up and knocking and asking their riddles. On the sofa, her father held the Nixon mask in front of his face and said, I'm the one, or me, I'm the answer. Sammy heard him and his pleased chuckle, but the children, eager to move on, paid no attention. When the last of the beggars had come and gone, she and her father sat down to the chowder. He said to her, your mother, Thelma Goodrow Dunley, is making her own genealogy now because she's discovered I'm making one. Can you beat that? She comes into the genealogy room at the historical building and pretends not to see me. He chewed, scowling. It's a good laugh when all the chairs are taken except the wobbly one directly across the table from my spot. Ha! He looked at his daughter. Damn it, Sammy, this is good grease, but I wish we hadn't discussed your mother's profession. Papa, tell me about the genealogy you're working on. No one sits in my chair. They know I'm coming, the old farts. He wiped his mouth. I'll tell you this, it's difficult. Finding information? Your great-grandfather, John Peter Dunley, was 55 when my father was born. His wife was 30 years younger, the first foreigner, far as I can determine, to marry a Dunley. Tweet, her name was, Norwegian. All that stuff's easy. It's the sitting there thinking about them that's difficult. Their lives, what was in their tickers? All these old people, my colleagues, scrabbling for names and dates and going home happy as larks. Well, names and dates, Sammy, what good are they? He stood up and looked for his coat. Leaves, yellow and slick, stuck to their shoes. She was walking her father home. A cry now and again issued from the darkness. A late ghost or goblin dashed across their moony path. The little man beside her was quiet. Then her heart quickened when she remembered how once he brought a wooden peacock that he carved and painted without them knowing about it into their kitchen and set it on the table. She was just tall enough to see it stand there all fanned out on perfect black feet. Hold still, he said. Don't wiggle the table. That was to her because she was so excited. He fixed a feather in her hair and gave her mother one too. And then she and her mother closed their eyes, for he told them to do that, and wish hard. And when they looked again, the wooden peacock was real and was stepping around the sugar bowl. How did he do that? Papa, I'm not deaf. I know what you mean, though. Names and dates are not enough. We've discussed this. Okay, but tell me how you turned that wooden peacock into a real one. You remember when? Ah, tell me. Nothing to tell. I don't remember. You do remember. There's your mother's sign lit up like Christmas. Foot care. Ha! Wait, Papa, please. You can't forget the one you carved. We had it for years. We took it to California that first time. It was beautiful. California, it's warm. That's all you can say for it. Look, your mother's in the window, spying on us. Where's my mask? He found it in his Target bag and put it on. They went in then, into the front room that years ago was Aunt Jelly's parlor, but that now, Aunt Jelly gone to the grave, was her mother's office. One entire wall was lined with little jars of vitamins and teas and wooden rollers to exercise your arches on, and on another wall hung big posters of feet like tracks made by someone who could walk up any obstacle, feet with bones showing through, bright as icicles, and arrows with bold legends pointing out exactly what was what. Phalanges of great toe, calcineus. Her mother turned from the window, from tendrils of ivy flowing over and down the sash, and said, they tried to steal my sign, the rascals, so I put a sun lamp bulb in the drop cord and hung it out. She looked Sammy's father up and down. I thought we ran this bum out of office. He shot both hands in the air, his fingers making V's. She sniffed and said to Sammy, did you and the president step in something? I smell a bad odor. Her father brought his hands down and mumbled. I think it's the mask, Sammy said. Pulling the lower part of the mask away from his mouth, but not taking it off, her father said, "That's what I said. Now I'm going up to my cell. Good night." Sammy hugged him, whispering, "You do remember that peacock. Don't lie to me." Then she helped him remove his coat. He draped it over his arm. He stood there facing them, still in his mask. And suddenly Sammy felt as if they were all in a play, a school play, something silly. And this boy shows up on stage playing Richard Nixon home from the wars with an old army coat over his arm and tufts of white hair sticking up every which way around the top of the mask. And she's ready to laugh because it's supposed to be funny. This boy always makes them laugh. But something isn't going right. The boy just stands there in a smelly mask with grotesque cheeks. And then her mother said, "Don't forget to take that ridiculous thing off your face, Jack Dunley." His back stiffened. He left the room. Her mother called after him, I'll make some tea if you like." They heard him climb the stairs, mumbling. Her mother sighed. "He won't be back. It's just as well." She went to make the tea for herself and for Sammy. Sammy stood alone in her mother's office. She felt small, displaced. She looked at the big feet on the wall. She went over and touched one. The slick paper crackled, and she thought of crickets, of straw and hay, and how they smell on summer nights. She thought of Howard the Mule and how good he smelled when you came running into the barn first thing on cold mornings, and how his skin shivered to shake off flies. The mule and maybe the barn and the house, too, were gone now, but maybe not. And maybe what she ought to do was pack them all in her rickety Volvo and drive out there. Maybe that would snap them out of this. Then she heard the tea kettle whistle in the kitchen, followed by another whistle behind her. She turned. It was her father. He had a finger to his lips, meaning she should be quiet. He tiptoed into the room, hunched over like a thief. He was holding something behind his back. He tiptoed over to her mother's desk. What he had behind his back was a mouse in a trap, which he now placed on the desk. Then he pulled from his pocket the Nixon mask and placed it face up over the trap. He winked at Sammy. "Let's see how quick she is," he whispered, and left the room. She looked out her window at the children on the bridge. The name Junior Potts hung in the gray air, and a girl in a coat bright as autumn, yellow and red, whirled around at two small boys and faced them. They pretended to be afraid of her, making noises like the wind. "Ahoo! Ahoo!" Their knees went all wobbly. Their arms dangled. They looked like the marmosets that Sammy fed and fell in love with one summer at the San Diego Zoo, the summer her parents sold Happy Joes to Boo Rat because they'd made a mistake. They were bored to their bones making ocean burgers. They hated Oceanside. No, the military, the government's policy in Vietnam, law and order, everyone in his little box, coffins, the cardboard whales they served the hamburgers in were daily signs of it. "Boku, Boku," her father said bitterly. And now Sammy saw him trying to make Boo Rap understand something, drawing maps, writing numbers on napkins, getting red in the face, turning over a ketchup bottle and hitting the bottom, barking "Boku, Boku," as if the word were rifle fire, sending spurts of ketchup all over the counter, and Boo Rap shaking his head, smiling, "Oh no, not him, no sir," and flexing his muscles, showing how the chipmunks chewed and chewed. At length, she looked up, focusing on the bridge again, and saw the two monkeys run past the girl, each holding an end of her yellow scarf and raising it like a banner. When did they stop liking each other? She asked Ursula. She asked Brendan and William and Georgia, all of them rosy-cheeked and smiling and shrugging their shoulders, busy working at their jobs. "Ask them," they said. "How do you ask your parents a question like that?" she said. And they said, "Don't ask." She spoke to Ursula through the wire fence at the daycare. "I know you and the others are only pretending indifference because otherwise none of you would be here. Where would we go? Where would I go?" Her sister was swinging one end of a skip rope, A little girl held the other end, and a second girl was jumping over it. The girls were counting in Spanish. "You lived in Mexico. You loved it there," Sammy said. "I like it here too, Sam, especially now that you're back." "But why are we back?" Her sister laughed. "Oh, Sammy," she said, "you're such a philosopher." Then to the rope jumper, "Okay, Marvella, it's Jimmy's turn." Sammy spoke to Georgia at the co-op, helping her unload bags of bran and wheat germ from a truck. She spoke to Brendan while he raked leaves for the city, to William while he chopped wood at Living History Farms. They all said she was such a philosopher. They all said they were glad to see her back among them. But she wasn't a philosopher. She was just as simple and down-to-earth as they were. She taught people the basics, to say, "Hello, goodbye, I live on Brattleboro Street. My name is Tuan and Mai and Min. I wish to take the bus. Please make change for me." "No, Ty, not to cause different, you smart aleck. We are talking about money here, coin, filthy lucre. To take the bus, to use the telephone, to get from one place to another, you sometimes need exact change." And to that, Ty, her quick one, saying, "Precise different, yes?" "Yes, yes indeed." Meantime, Ty, holding up his legal tender and speaking clearly, is brushed away by the busy clerk. And her parents, meantime, not saying much at all, have made change. Games. What she wanted to know was why, after all the marching and hand-holding and passion they'd been through, her parents were like this. Never mind the divorce, her father paying rent. Those things were silly and superficial. What she wanted to know was underneath. What she wanted to know had blood in it, surprise, purpose, memory, yes, something besides names and dates. She noticed she was making a small circle on the application form below the names of her brothers and sisters and parents, going round and round on the same track. She stopped that. She gave the circle a long beak. Now she gave it wings, an eye. And all over again, she could see her parents side by side in the orchard, covered with honeybees. It was as if they were wearing suits, bee-woolly, bee-buzzing long johns. No, not buzzing, humming. Like the end of a tune that stays in your head at bedtime when you lay quietly on the pillow waiting for sleep. And it never occurred to her to be afraid for them under all that swarm. In fact, she sat down in the tall grass and watched, astonished, as the swarm, moving ever so slightly, rippled and shone, causing her parents' shapes to seem like reflections in a warped mirror or on water. And then two more interesting things happened. First, her parents put their gauze and bee-covered faces close to each other, whispering, trying to kiss. And then, suddenly, like a blanket, the bees were pulled off. Who pulled them off? At the kitchen table, Sammy put her head down, resting it on her forearms, and closed her eyes. She wanted to savor that memory. Underneath her arms lay the application form, her brothers' and sisters' and parents' names, the crudely drawn bee. She had those things in her head, too. The nose on the bee drawing was her father's, long and fine. He was in the orchard with her mother, their bee furry faces almost touching, and then the bees were gone. Her mother had leaves in her hair and was saying his name, "Jack, oh Jack," as if he had just surprised her, made her laugh. He did make her laugh, and Sammy watched them, quietly laughing with them, and then when they did kiss, she closed her eyes and kept them closed and was quiet as a mouse. Now another time came to her, Oregon, when they were living with some other families on a farm. They had goats and fruit trees and chickens. A morning's walk brought you to the ocean. Ursula was not with them now. She had gone to Canada with a boy from Berkeley. Then Brendan, who was 19, went somewhere. No one would say where. He had refused to register for the draft. Sammy can still see him collecting the round black goat droppings, the goat balls, he said he planned to mail to the Pentagon. Then William, almost 18, was gone, along with the rooster, who stayed in his room and followed him everywhere. One morning, Sammy found her mother wiping her eyes in the hen house, but as with Brendan, neither she nor anyone else said a word about William's absence. Georgia and the twins attended school in the little town, but when Georgia turned 16, she quit and caught a ride with some people who were passing through to Oakland. She got a job in a vegetarian restaurant down there. That left Sammy and the twins. The twins were 13. They said they were happy just where they were for a change. They were tired of demonstrations, running off here and there. Agnes, a college dropout who lived with them, made puppets, and Holly and Teak were making puppets now too, and putting on shows after dinner. They invented a couple named Joe and Mrs. Joe, who had several children, Spyro, Dick, Pat, John, Martha, and a pet bulldog named Jolly Edgar. Despite repeated instruction, Jolly Edgar was always leaving his secrets in the house where people would step in them. The children were not very smart either, and Joe and Mrs. Joe were forever teaching them some simple lesson: how to fix a flat, how to brush their teeth, how to wash their socks without being seen in a gas station restroom. Holly and Teak's audience loved these skits. Night after night, their audience wanted to see them again, roaring in laughter even before a skit had begun. Her eyes still closed, Sammy saw their flushed faces. Then she saw her parents again in the orchard. Her mother's hair was long and red and sparkling with leaves. Her father was dancing up and down, holding his first fingers out from his head like horns, saying, "Baa," and coming after her. In the middle of this reverie, she heard a noise, not very loud. She looked up. Someone was knocking at the door. She did not want to answer it. She wanted to go back in her head to the orchard again and hear her parents laugh. But the little knock came once more. "No," she thought, "whoever you are, not now." She waited. Again it came. Quietly, she went to the door and listened. It could not be her father, for his knock was a loud, no-nonsense pounding. Perhaps it was Donna, the dancer from the apartment below. She listened. Finally, she heard footsteps going away down the stairs. Then the sound of the outer door opening, closing. She returned to the kitchen and looked out the window. She saw little Ty beside the house wearing that blue baseball cap that was too big for him and the red satin jacket he found at Goodwill that said Fred's Electric on the back in blocky yellow letters and was also too big for him. Ty was looking at the sky, his round face under the long bill of the baseball cap in a wide smile. It was snowing very lightly, the first snowfall of the year. He held out his palm. Sammy watched him. A little man in a bright red jacket, a figure from this distance who might have been 5 or 50, trying to catch snow. She looked at the gray sky and wished more snow would fall for him. Big, fat, sparkling flakes, enough for a snowman. He was walking toward the bridge over the freeway now. She opened her window. "Ty," she called, "Ty." But he was near the bridge now, too near the noisy, homeward-bound traffic to hear her. When he stepped on the bridge, he suddenly thrust out his arms as if he were a circus performer, balancing himself on a wire. Sammy watched as he moved across the bridge, her bright clown carefully placing one foot in front of the other. In the middle, he paused, jerkily tilting his torso left, then right, back and forth several times like that, in a parody of almost losing his balance. Then he rushed to the other side. He ran down the walkway, his red jacket billowing, filling with air, and disappeared. Sammy stood by the open window. She gazed at the gray, goat-colored sky. She listened to the traffic hum. Closing her eyes, she could hear the ocean, a swarm of bees, a crowd of people singing a hymn. Thank you. Well, with a little more practice, I think I'm going to start reading. I like that story. I forgot how much I did like it. It probably has some references in it that might be a little historical for some folks of a certain age, but not for me. No, not for me. No. I can remember joining hands and walking to that golden dome in Des Moines, the capital. Well, a little Q&A, which I'm happy to do here. I'm going to find my glass of water. Can you see my Boston Red Sox shirt pretty well from over there?
Yes, thank you.
Well, I covered everything probably tonight. Now, I know you're not shy, Martha. But you know all these stories.
Do you know how to get out of here?
Pardon me?
Do you know how to get out of here?
3 years ago, this is remarkable. Three years ago, I know, Doug and Patty sitting here in the front row have lived in Flint for many, many years. And have come this way often. Anyway, I wasn't sure that I could find their house from here for some reason. Anyway, Patty decided she was going to ride with me, and we were going to follow Doug as we made our way toward Flint. And we got lost. How is that possible? I was walking around the campus tonight. I was saying, how is it possible? I mean, I went to school here. I drove between here and Flint many times. How is it possible?
We got lost.
Yeah, we ended up way out somewhere. But new roads have been built, new things have been designed, and we got on the wrong one, didn't we? Yeah. We ran into some revelers way out in a pasture somewhere, didn't we? Yeah. I don't know what they were doing out there.
It was funny.
Yeah. That was 3 years ago, but that's not going to happen tonight because I'm staying here tonight.
Learned your lesson.
Well, thanks for coming. Did that last story I read, was that clear? I felt at times I was, because I hadn't read it to an audience before. This was its North American debut.
What's it like being on the road?
Every fall, I get in my pickup and I leave Idaho, I leave my mountain, and I head toward Michigan. My mother lives in Grand Blanc, and I figure it's a good time to go and have dinner with her. So along the way, I give readings, and I also have a daughter who teaches high school English in Iowa, so I stop there. And my grandson, Gabriel, who is at Cornell College on a soccer and academic scholarship, I get to see him play a soccer game. And he's a freshman. And things like that. I get to see Doug and Patty and other people. I get to stop in at the press. And nobody's there when I stop in. They're all in a meeting. Yeah, you were to me. Yeah. Breezed in. I have 10 months out of the year on my mountain in solitude and quiet and, you know, living the life that I love doing. And I get up in the morning and I have breakfast and go outside for a little bit, have a brief chat with my barn cat, Yada. You know, we have a little conversation. I ask her how she passed the night, if there's anything I should know about, you know, if anything unusual happened that we can discuss. If it's in the spring or the summer, I look at my gardens. I have a flower garden and a vegetable garden. I don't dwell out there right after breakfast. It's just to go out to kind of, you know, get smell the day and stuff. And then then I go back in and I spend 3 hours at my studio and writing, and then I have lunch, and then I go back outside and I do something physical to kind of balance the interior experience of the day. And I work in the garden, or I split wood, firewood, or I go fishing. I can go down. I can take the brake off my pickup and just go down the mountain, and I'm at one of the world's best trout streams, and I can catch a couple of nice trout for dinner. And then in the evening, after dinner, I read, and I go to bed at a decent hour. And I'm happy. I'm happy as a tick on a mule's behind. Yeah.
So you write about 3 hours a day?
Yeah, 3 hours. And I've been at this for so long now that, and because I'm very faithful to it, three is plenty. Three is good. And I get a lot done.
Find your way to Iowa.
I was teaching in Iowa at Drake. I had an academic position there, and I had that for 25 years, although I was not there for 25 years. I went off and taught elsewhere from time to time, including here at one point, and some other places. or I just would take off on my own nickel sometimes and go someplace to live. I woke up one morning, for example, and realized I had to live in Paris before I died, or I would be terribly irked on my deathbed if I had not done that. So I did. I went off and I lived there for a year, and it was great, and other places. And I like teaching a lot. And that's another reason why I go on these tours, because I visit with students in classrooms, and I get to have the very best, you know, the discussion. I don't have to give grades or anything. This is going to be a large answer, but I decided that I would just be a writer for a change. And so I got a good look at the Northwest when I was teaching at Reed College in Portland. I gave a lot of readings in the Northwest, and I met some people out there that I became friends with and kept in touch. And I love the Clearwater Mountains. They're beautiful. The county that I live in, Idaho County, is as big as New Jersey and has only one stoplight in the entire county. And it stretches almost from Montana on the east to Washington and Oregon on the west. And it's just obviously very green. A lot of trees and a lot of water. It's quiet. And there are a lot of writers in the Northwest, a lot of people who have managed to, you know, to leave their day jobs, have moved out there. And but in the fall, I like getting in touch with my audience, and that's why I go on these tours. And it also makes me appreciate my mountain. All the more. It's the only place I've ever lived. When I'm leaving there, when I'm driving down the mountain, I'm already thinking about coming back. I've never lived, and I've lived in some nice places, and that's the only place I've ever lived where I get that feeling. But I do like going on the road, and it's not that hard. I arrange the readings pretty much like beads on a rosary, and I just go from one to the next. And except for out west, where schools are you know, quite a distance apart, once I get into Missouri, they're close together, and it's not difficult at all. last fall was the longest tour I've ever made. I usually do about 22. This fall I'm doing 23 appearances. Last fall I did 20. I had 22 set up, all fixed. Then I got a call from the state of Georgia, asking me if I wanted to do the Georgia Poetry Circuit, which would involve 12 schools in the state of Georgia. And I was already going to be in Tennessee, or close to Tennessee, so I said, okay, you know, so I tacked on those 12, so I had 34. And I do this entire circuit in my pickup. I mean, can you imagine going up and down in an airplane 22 or 23 times and all the stuff that entails? I mean, I would be crazy at the end. I would be just a wreck. So I ended up last fall driving 9,000 miles. Three times, in effect, three.
Georgia's a big state now. If you're driving
out of
Georgia.
It is, yeah, it is. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel it at all.
Yeah.
But had someone said to me before I left home, hey, look, you're Or even while I was setting this tour up, if someone said, now look, in effect, you're going to be driving three times across the country, I would have said, no, I'm not interested. That's too much. That's way too much. But I did it, and really, while I was doing it, it was easy. But when I got home, I was a little slow for about a week.
And
about a week, I think, yeah.
The cat
yeah.
probably had a lot to tell you by then.
Yeah, she did, yeah.
When you write, do you get, you say there's other writers out there. When you write, do you share your writing in progress
no.
with other people?
No.
Or do you do it alone and then publish it?
Alone, yeah. Yeah, alone. Now, a man named Paul Zimmer, who is a poet, fine poet, who started, and also a fine publisher. He will be remembered as a fine publisher. He started the University of Pittsburgh Press Poetry Series, which is now a very large poetry series, huge, very successful. He started that. And then he left there. He was the business manager there at Pittsburgh at first. As he came up through the sales end of things. So he knew the book business from the sales end, but he was a reader, great reader, and so he got into editorial easily enough. And then, I think largely on the strength of the Pitt Poetry Series, he was offered the job as director of the University of Georgia Press. He went there for a while and did well, but then he was offered the directorship of the University of Iowa Press. He took that. He wanted to come back to the Midwest. And he and I, over the years, we became friends. Pittsburgh published my first book way back, 1969. And we became immediate friends, and I had a lot in common. And he had a ping pong table in his basement, and he had it so situated that he could beat me there. I mean, he could beat me, and I'm a superior ping pong player. But he always beat me. Always beat me, and that was another reason why our friendship lasted. I mean, it's lasted as long as it has, because it makes him feel good when he can beat somebody who's clearly superior to him. He and I exchange poems, and only poems in progress, but where I get my feedback is from editors that for years, after when you're at this business for a long time, you develop relationships with certain editors. And I had a good one, for example, with a man named Stanley Lindbergh, who edited a great literary journal called the Georgia Review. He's now dead, I'm sorry to say, but one of the great editors, Stan Lindbergh. And he was a big help to me. I'd send him something, and he'd either take it and tinker with it, or he wouldn't take it, and he'd say something about it. So that kind of feedback you get. Yeah.
The first man's name was Zimmer?
Zimmer, Z-I-M-M-E-R, Paul Zimmer. Very funny man, has a great sense of humor. So I know him very well. So we both tease each other and tell stories about one another. They're not true, but they could be true, but they're not.
There's a story there.
There is, yeah. Yeah. No, writers spend an awful lot of time alone, quietly. I mean, that's as it should be. That's the way it is. That's the nature of the job. And that's another reason why I go on these tours, because it allows me to get a little bit of a change. Yeah. I do have a garrulous side to me. That probably hasn't come through here today, but I can have fun with a group of people. I'm not a hermit really at heart, but I do. One cannot explain it. Writers really, because they're not interested in explaining it. But one can be friendly and garrulous, or even have a garrulous streak, and still love being alone on a regular basis. Just the way it works. Yeah. Well, I think we did it, didn't we? Yep, great.